Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's 1838 India. From the Bay of Bengal to Calcutta and up the Ganges, British traders rule. Opium traders. Over riverside fields once full of food crops, now awash in an endless expanse of poppies. The opium trade to China is imperiled. Opium war looms. And so begins novelist Amitav Ghosh's latest book. It's a high drama, high seas tale, and at its heart is a tall-masted, one-time American slave ship out of Baltimore with a crew from all over. This hour on Point, Amitav Ghosh on his epic Sea of Poppies. You can join the conversation. Have you read it? Been transported to its polyglot, cultural mashup, opium days? How do you weigh the romance against the brutality of the time? Joining me now in the studio is novelist Amitav Ghosh. He's the internationally best-selling author of The Glass Palace and The Hungry Tide. Born in Calcutta, took a social anthropology PhD at Oxford, married American, now divides his time between Brooklyn and India. His new novel, first volume in a planned trilogy shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, is Sea of Poppies. The reviews have been rave. Amitav Ghosh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you, and what a time and place and panorama you lay out here. And, I mean, I have to say, as somebody who ran off as a teenager to India with his French-born girlfriend and took up on the Bay of Bengal, you're pushing all my buttons. I was an easy mark for this one, but this is just tremendous. Wonderful, wonderful. Describe the time you set it in for us. I've just begun, but give us more flavor of this 1838 and the crux of time and place.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for that wonderful response to the book. You know, the 1830s, I started thinking about, you know, setting this story in the 1830s, mainly because that was the period of when the Indian indentured migration began. You know, it was in this period that a lot of people began to leave India as indentured workers.
Coolies, as they were often known.
That's right, coolies, mm-hmm. That's right.
Slavery made illegal by the British, but here was something kind of almost in between free and slave. And
yes, I mean, it was really, they were really sort of unfree labor, mm-hmm. is what you might call it. Mind you, it's, I mean, they traveled in the same way as slaves did, on slave ships often, and it was just as hard. You know, the work was just as hard, the mortality rates were just mm-hmm. as bad, mm-hmm. but it was somewhat different from slavery, and I think one has to acknowledge that because, you know, just as a sort of tribute to the abolitionists, really, who managed to do away with slavery proper. Mm. So it was, I mean, the conditions were marginally better than slavery. But, you know, it was in this period that a very large number of Indians began to leave. So, you know, I got interested in that and I started writing about it. And then, of course, I discovered that, you know, these people who left came basically from two or three districts in northern Bihar. Mm-hmm. And these two or three districts were where the opium poppy was being grown by the British East India Company.
Wall-to-wall poppies everywhere.
In winter, at least.
I mean, the opium trade had just taken over this world in this time, as you described here. It was, it made such fortunes. It was so much the backbone of the emerging empire's wealth. It's kind of astounding to see the centrality of it. Describe for us just how key, important, huge, deep opium was at this time.
Well, yeah, that's you know, one can't really say it taken over in a sort of passive sense because it was the British East India Company which really was generated.
Propagated. Yes,
yes. Yeah.
Well, no, it wasn't by accident.
No, it was
very
by
deliberate.
Accident at all. In fact, the local farmers weren't that keen to grow the opium poppy because, you know, opium poppy is the cultivation of it is incredibly labor intensive mm-hmm. and very, very demanding.
Scraping the goop out of each pod at just the right moment before it hardens up and is worthless.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the alkaloids are only potent for 10 days. Mm-hmm. So it's in exactly those 10 days that you have to nick the poppy and then you have to sort of let it bleed overnight and then you have to go and collect the gum and, you know, it's just a tiny bit of gum from each pod.
But we're talking vast amounts and vast numbers of people to come up with the amount of poppy opium that would ultimately be processed and packed, and you described that vividly, we'll hear some of that, and then packed into the ships and sailed off to the great market of that time, China, which was not so happy at a certain point about getting all this opium.
Yeah, you know, curiously, people seem to think that that China had always been a sort of great market for opium, but that's not true at all. This market was, in fact, created by Dutch and British traders, you know, who were basically trying to settle a balance of payments problem. Because, you know, at that time, the West wanted all sorts of things from China. They wanted
silks and teas and silk.
Absolutely. And, you know, so...
And China had nothing else. I mean, the West had nothing or little else that China wanted.
Absolutely. The Chinese didn't want Western-made goods because they had their own stuff. Mm-hmm. So the British East India Company found that the one thing that they did need in China...
Or could be led to need.
Led to need. Well, one thing was cotton, Indian mm-hmm. raw
yeah,
cotton.
Okay, yeah.
The other thing was opium. So they self-consciously set about creating and expanding the market for opium in China. It was completely illegal in China. I mean, the Chinese government tried very, very hard from the 1730s onwards to resist the smuggling of opium.
The woman kind of at the heart of this, and it's a big cast of characters, but there's Diti, who's on one of these in this agricultural area, the Sea of Poppies, growing opium for this vast and hungry kind of budding empire. Diti is her name. Rough lot with her husband and his family. There's a passage. He actually has been wounded in war earlier as a soldier. Works in an opium factory. She has to go fetch him one day. And now there's a passage in the book where she's making her way through this enormous opium processing factory up the Ganges from Calcutta. There's just one bit of it here where they're down trudging through the raw muck making the opium. I wish you'd read for us.
Sure. Now, this is Aditi's entered the Ghazipur opium factory. And mm-hmm. Now, once again, Diti was taken aback by the space ahead. But this time, not because of the vastness of its dimensions, but rather the opposite. It was like a dim tunnel, lit only by a few small holes in the wall. The air inside was hot and fetid, like that of a closed kitchen, except that the smell was not of spices and oil, but of liquid opium, mixed with the dull stench of sweat, a reek so powerful that she had to pinch her nose to keep herself from gagging. No sooner had she steadied herself than her eyes were met by a startling sight. A host of dark, legless torsos was circling around and around like some enslaved tribe of demons. This vision, along with the overpowering fumes, made her groggy, and to keep herself from fainting, she began to move slowly ahead. When her eyes had grown more accustomed to the gloom, she discovered the secret of those circling torsos. They were bare-bodied men, sunk waist-deep in tanks of opium, tramping round and around to soften the sludge. Their eyes were vacant, glazed, and yet somehow they managed to keep moving, as slow as ants in honey, tramping, treading. When they could move no more, they sat on the edges of the tanks, stirring the dark ooze only with their feet. These seated men had more the look of ghouls than any living thing she had ever seen. Their eyes glowed red in the dark, and they appeared completely naked, their loincloths, if indeed they had any, being so steeped in the drug as to be indistinguishable from their skin. Almost as frightening were the white overseers who were patrolling the walkways, for not only were they coatless and hatless, with their sleeves rolled, but they were also armed with fearsome instruments, metal scoops, glass ladles, and long-handled rakes. When one of those overseers approached, she all but screamed. She heard him say something. What it was, she did not wish to know, but the very shock of being spoken to by such a man sent her scurrying down the tunnel and out at the far end.
And that's just maybe near the beginning of a journey. Amitav Ghosh reading there from his wonderful new novel, Sea of Poppies, first in a trilogy. I mean, this is a very colorful, sprawling story, high spirits, high humor, high drama, but a tremendous brutality at the heart of it. And I wondered if it read to me at times like your indictment of early globalization. And I don't know if you're that political or not. What's politics and what's theater, drama, here?
Well, I was writing this book, you know, through this period of, you know, the Iraq War period, 2003 onwards. Mm. And it's true that, you know, that there are some strange and really weird similarities between the Iraq War and the first Opium War.
That is, when China was trying to say no to opium,
that's
and
right.
the East India Trading Company was having none of it, sent the sepoys to push it down their throats.
No, it was actually the British government. I mean, mm-hmm. They sent, they attacked China basically to force opium upon them in the name of free trade and the free market. And I think it's strange that, you know, in this entire period when we heard people just, you know, talking about all the great gifts of the free market and what a wonderful thing it is, that in fact they never mention, you know, that this was one of the originary acts of, you know, the free trade system that is forcing opium upon China.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Amitabh Ghosh about his epic new novel, the first of a trilogy spanning India, China, and the 19th century opium trade and opium wars. It's called Sea of Poppies. I just finished it up on a long flight from Boston to Salt Lake City and back a couple of flights. A tremendous read. He joins me in the studio today. We'll come to the cast of characters here in just a second, but I wish you'd read just a bit more for us, because there's a great passage here which gets into the traders' sort of view of themselves in this whole formula and how much was forgiven or brushed aside on moral grounds in the interest of what they saw as, making a lot of money, but B, they wrapped the civilizing progress of the West into the East and everywhere else around. There's a conversation here between the trader, I guess it's Burnham, who's a fabulously successful kind of up from nothing or not much to build a big position in the opium trade. And Zachary Reed, who is what, born of a freed slave in America, in the United States?
Yes.
And has kind of by accident nearly come out of the Baltimore shipyards on this slaver, one-time slaver, the ship Ibis, the Ibis.
Yes.
And finds himself suddenly up from kind of nothing into the world of this very rich Calcutta-based British trader who's giving him some sense of where he's headed in practical and ethical terms.
Yes. Well, I should point out that the irony of it is that Zachary is himself African-American.
Yes.
Except that he's very...
His mother had been a slave, but he doesn't look it and he hasn't said it.
That's right. That's right. So he's mistaken for a white man.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Burnham is, of course, an opium trader, but these were the neocons of that era, you know. So.
Okay.
Okay. The Ibis won't be carrying opium on her first voyage, Reed, said Mr. Burnham. The Chinese have been making trouble on that score, and until such time as they can be made to understand the benefits of free trade, I'm not going to send any more shipments to Canton. Till then, this vessel is going to do just the kind of work she was intended for. The suggestion startled Zachary. Do you mean to use her as a slaver, sir? But have not your English laws outlawed that trade? That is true, Mr. Burnham nodded. Yes, indeed they have, Reed. It's sad but true that there are many who'll stop at nothing to halt the march of human freedom. Freedom, sir? Said Zachary, wondering if he had misheard. His doubts were quickly put at rest. Freedom! Yes, exactly, said Mr. Burnham. Isn't that what the mastery of the white man means for the lesser races? As I see it, Reed, the Africa trade was the greatest exercise in freedom since God led the children of Israel out of Egypt. Consider, Reed, the situation of a so-called slave in the Carolinas. Is he not more free than his brethren in Africa, groaning under the rule of some dark tyrant? Zachary tugged his earlobe. Well, sir, if slavery is freedom, then I'm glad I don't have to make a meal of it. Whips and chains are not much to my taste. Oh, come now, Reed, said Mr. Burnham. The march to the shining city is never without pain, is it? Didn't the Israelites suffer in the desert? Reluctant to enter into an argument with his new employer, Zachary mumbled, Well, sir, I guess. This was not good enough for Mr. Burnham, who quizzed him with a smile. I thought you were a pukka kind of chap, Reed, he said. And here you are, carrying on like one of those reformer fellows. Am I, sir? Said Zachary quickly. I didn't mean to. Thought not, said Mr. Burnham. Lucky thing that particular disease hasn't taken hold in your parts yet. Last bastion of liberty, I always say. Slavery will be safe in America for a while yet. Where else could I have found a vessel like this, so perfectly suited for its cargo?
Amitav Ghosh reading from Sea of Poppies, and that vessel, the Ibis, upon which all the diverse characters of this sprawling novel will finally find themselves on quite a wild voyage, the first of a trilogy. And he's making his kids so-called slaves in Carolina. Is he not more free than his brethren in Africa, you write here?
This was actually an argument that was repeatedly made by people who defended slavery.
What, they're just lucky to get close to Western civilization, even if in chains?
That was exactly the argument. Their argument was exactly that they were taking people away in the to freedom, meaning slavery. But I think it's just a sort of, it's one of the things that, when you hear the word freedom used by certain people in certain contexts, you know that it means exactly the opposite of what is being implied.
You know, I was struck. Your book has been, compared with Dickens and Melville and all that. And yes, I mean, there's a wonderful literary depth and resonance and quality. But there's something else, speaking of globalization, going on here, because I, having spent a lot of time in Asia decades ago, I mean, it was a time, even before, but there came out this whole string of books, Shogun, Noble House, and James Clavell, and right on. And this little Patrick O'Brien in yours, too, with that Daring Do on the High Seas. But in those times, the exoticism of that interaction of East and West, these authors clearly loved and exploited. But it was very much still from a Western perspective. The heroes were the taipans and the guys who came in. Now, here you are, Amitav Ghosh, in some ways telling a similar story. I mean, the excitement, the exoticism of it can't be denied even in your work, but it's from a point of view of familiarity, of intimacy, and from an Eastern point of view. You're kind of turning it around and making the Western one-time heroes, now interlopers, much more morally checkered at best.
Checkered, I think, is a troublesome word, because in fact, these opium traders, many of whom were also slavers once upon a time. I mean, it's very hard to think of what might figure in the sort of good deeds column. I mean, because these were
I say at best.
Yes. I mean, these were incredibly horrible people. I mean, doing something just which they themselves knew to be utterly corrupt and awful. And it wasn't just, Englishmen. There were Indians involved in the opium trade. There were many, many Americans. One of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's ancestors was trading in opium in China. I mean, a lot of your East Coast money came from the opium trade. When people talk about the China trade,
yes, indeed,
that's what they really mean.
Kind of euphemism, very often, number of fortunes. And yet, you weave an absolutely compelling story out of it that will not be, people are not going to be put off. You're not preachy here, and yet you're just showing it. This is maybe the 21st century when an Indian novelist just tells the same gripping story, but the compass settings are different. Be generous enough to share with us some of the cast of characters here, kind of, if you would.
Sure. The story is, in the end, really a story about a ship, and it's the ship, the Ibis, where a lot of different people come together, people from completely different sort of backgrounds and so on.
Yeah, this is not Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. No. So, we have these three officers. One of them is called Zachary Reed. He's the American.
The African-American slave mother.
That's right. And there's an English first mate called Mr. Crowell. There's an English captain. Then there are all these Indian sailors, one of whom particularly figures as a major character in my book. His name is Jodu. And he's just a young sailor, a Lascar, as they used to be called in those days. So he's a part of this ship.
Who's been thrown in one of the many examples of intimacy that you had at that time, which made me think maybe in some strange way intimacies were greater than now. I mean, he happened to be the sort of near brother through a nursemaid situation with a young French girl in Calcutta whose father was at the botanical gardens. I mean, the entwining of Eastern and Western folks at that time, when their worlds did cross, was very intimate.
Very, very intimate, because it is actually the case that, many of the Westerners who grew up in Asia, actually were brought up by Asians, you know.
They're not just passing in airports. His Jadu's mother was her wet nurse.
Absolutely, brought her up.
Suckled at the breast there.
Absolutely, and, you know, like, say, Rudyard Kipling, you know, mm-hmm. He didn't speak any English until he was four or something.
Mm-hmm.
He only spoke Indian languages. So it was a very common situation. So anyway, there you mm-hmm. have
There's a couple,
Jadu.
And then there's Diti and her man as it evolves.
Yes, Diti is the farmer and her husband.
An ox cart driver, a giant
right.
of a man.
That's right.
Ultimately, she right, and then Burnham, the super rich trader.
The opium trader, and we have this Indian aristocrat who's tried for forgery and and sent off to sentenced to transportation to Mauritius. So he's on the ship as well as a half Chinese convict. Whose father is Indian, Parsi, and his mother is a boatwoman in Canton. So we have all these people on this ship. I think it's a fairly accurate portrait of what a ship in those days would have been like, actually, because I did look up a lot of crew manifests and passenger manifests.
Clearly. And you've got this the Chinese or half-Chinese convict out of Canton who's, with a father... Let's see, what was the relationship?
His father is a Bombay-based opium merchant.
That's right. And he ultimately trained in Kung Fu, can snatch flies out of the air. We have all sorts of miracles here, and clearly the whole thing rolling toward the opium wars, which don't quite come in here yet, but you've got a trilogy planned. It is quite a scene. I want to turn to some of the folks we're calling in to speak with you. From Montpelier, Vermont, Michelle. Michelle, you're on the air with Amitav Ghosh.
Hello.
Hi.
Amitav. And hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just say, since this is my only opportunity, excuse me, that I loved In an Antique Land, your novel, which is about the Mediterranean basin and the cultures mingling there. And I think it was 12th century. It's been a few years. But I just thought it was a beautiful novel. I told many people about it, and it seemed to me it was a vision of mingling of cultures that was quite peaceful. It was a peaceful era, and the trade goes from India to Palestine to Egypt, and there are Jews and Arabs and other and Indians and other people all mixing rather cordially. And I love that vision also of the 1200s.
Could you feel the anthropologist at work, Michelle,
there? Yes, well, there is a character. The anthropologist is actually in the modern world of Egypt at different times, and he is then, I don't remember, maybe he's telling the story of the past or something. So you go back and forth between what's happening in Egypt at different times that the anthropologist is there in modern times, in our current time, and then this world in the 1200s, but I particularly love that vision of that world.
In an antique land. Wonderful there. Michelle, thanks for calling. Let me get one more, and we'll think about it. Allison in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Amitav Ghosh.
Hi. I really enjoyed the passages that the author has been reading on your program, and he also mentioned having looked at crew manifests, ship manifests, and I was hoping he could just talk a little bit more about the kind of research he did and the sources he used to create this incredibly rich portrayal of the multiple worlds he's working in, whether he was working in Indian archives or in London with the papers of the East India Company, all the incredible work that must have gone into learning about this period.
Amitav, how about it? You're a trained anthropologist. You clearly put a bunch of your training to work here on a research project.
Sure. Well, to begin with, thank you very, very much, Michelle, for your very, very generous comments. And In an Antique Land was a book I really enjoyed writing. And, you know, it was a long time ago, but it's wonderful to know that it's still out there. And yes, you're right. It was about the 12th century. And it was about a period when I think a trade happened in ways that were not destructive to ways of life, to people, and where it led to a certain kind of intermingling and a certain sort of exchange, because a trade is a wonderful thing. It's how people meet. It's how they once interacted with each other. So thank you very much for your appreciation. For the other question, yes, the research. Well, I did a lot of, you know, I was teaching for a while at Harvard, so I did a lot of my research, in fact, in the Harvard Library. But I also did a lot of research at the Greenwich Maritime Museum, which has wonderful archives, especially of everything to do with ships. And I did some of my research in the Mauritius archives. It was very exciting because I like being in libraries. I like doing research. But especially looking up the crew manifests was something very, very interesting, because there's one very good source for it now, which is the online archives of the Sydney Harbour Master's Office.
This Sydney, in Australia.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because as you know, Australians have a great interest in their sort of genealogical mm-hmm. heritage. Mm-hmm. So every ship that arrived in Sydney has its crew and passenger manifest posted. And it was looking at these crew and passenger manifests that got me really, really interested in the story of Indian sailors. Because if you look at many of these ships, typically a ship sailing from, say, London to Sydney, such a ship would often have, let's say, three or four white officers. That, mm-hmm. You know, you can tell by their names and by their birthplaces. Then they would have 40 crewmen. And these 40 or so crewmen were very often they were Lascars, and they were Lascars from many different parts of Asia. So on the same ship, you would have sailors from China, from the Philippines, from East Africa, from India, from the Malay Islands, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then you would have, the passengers, the English passengers who were, going off to Australia.
And this at a time when that kind of mingling with that kind of intimacy was not the way of the world generally.
This was the, we're talking about the mid-19th century. But, you know, the sea has always been a place where people were thrust very much into contiguity. Mm-hmm. If you remember Melville's Moby Dick, the 40th chapter of it has this wonderful sort of sequence where all the crewmen on the Pequod are singing in different languages. Mm-hmm. And that's when you realize that this ship, a Nantucket whaling ship, actually is a sort of floating United Nations, you know. I mean, there are people from all around the world in it, including India.
When floating United Nations, when they're not being lashed to the rack and whipped to within an inch of their life, or tossed overboard, or sent out on death-defying missions on the prow, or I mean, you've got high drama in that stew of cultures and peoples as well.
It was a grim, hard life, you know. Mm. I mean, if you read, say, Richard Henry Dana's book, again, A Boston Man, mm-hmm. 2 years before the mast, you mm-hmm. see what an incredibly hard and grim life it was at sea. Yet these very sailors, you know, when they came back, they would dream of being at shore.
Yeah.
But when they came back, they would go off and they would spend a night or two on shore, and then they'd run back to their ships because they couldn't bear it.
लिख लिख पाती भेजो मैं शाम को.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Amitav Ghosh about his epic new novel, first of a trilogy spanning India, China, and the 19th century, Opium Wars. It's called Sea of Poppies. Amitav Ghosh joins me in the studio, author of The Glass Palace, The Hungry Tide, The Calcutta Chromosome, and, of course, In an Antique Land, we heard earlier. We've got Robert calling from Thetford, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air with Amitav Ghosh.
Amitav, it's Bob Nichols, Grace's husband.
Hello, Bob. How nice to hear from you.
I'm so happy to hear your voice. I just wanted to say hello, and I've read all your books. I particularly admire In an Antique Land, and I'm looking forward to reading The Sea of Poppies.
Well, I hope you enjoy it, Bob. I so enjoyed reading your manuscripts, and you know, we've all felt so sad since your wife Grace Paley passed away, and she was we miss her terribly.
Yes.
Grace Paley. Okay. So you know of what you speak, then, Bob. What is it about Amitav Ghosh that grabs you, Bob? His work.
Oh, he's a wonderful writer. His intelligence is, he's smarter and got a wonderful point of view. Certainly has some idea of politics, and also he's easy to read. He can be very funny and charming. So that's what I feel about him.
If I may ask, did Grace Paley, did she read his work as well?
Oh, she read his work too, of course.
We were. Grace was a very dear friend, a kind of mentor.
Yes, I know.
And so, you know, we just adored her, really. Yes. She was one of the most wonderful people.
And a favorite of so many. Robert, Bob, thank you so much for calling in with that. It's great to have you. Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Bye.
Let me get a call, if I can, from Boston. And Rajesh. Hi, Rajesh. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
A quick question. There was an interesting analogy that Amitabh was developing between the poppy trade and the Iraq war, which I think was left hanging. And I thought if he could say a little more about it.
Certainly.
Yeah, I had the same feeling and wondered if is oil the connection, or play it on out, if you would.
Oil, you know, oil is not really comparable to poppy, though you could talk about the addictions of empires.
Bush says we're addicted.
Well, yeah, and the British Empire was completely addicted to the opium trade because, in fact, I mean, the British Raj in India would not have been possible without the opium trade. I mean, it was one of their largest sources of income, and the most easily disposable source of income was, in fact, from opium.
Not to mention much of what we see and celebrate built in London.
Absolutely. You know, so many of the institutions of today's world were founded upon the opium trade. There's just no getting away from it. But the analogy between these two, I think what was really striking to me is the arguments that preceded the Opium War. I mean, just as we know that, there were oil interests behind the Iraq War. Similarly, merchants, especially the opium lobby, was lobbying the British trade, the British government very strongly in order to wage this war upon China. And the arguments in both cases were so similar. There was this talk about bringing freedom to the Chinese people. There was talk of overthrowing a tyrant. There was all this stuff about the free market. And you know, they even actually said, I mean, those British merchants said that when our troops go into Canton, they'll be cheering on the streets.
In the Opium War, to insist that they continue to import their opium.
Absolutely. Basically, the Chinese were just trying to resist, you know.
But President Bush didn't say, we've gone to Iraq for free trade. He said, we've gone to spread democracy and to quell and crush a tyrant, topple.
Yes, this was exactly what, very similar to the arguments that were used by the opium traders of that time. It was to spread freedom. It was to spread Christianity. It was to spread, it was to overthrow a tyrant. The arguments, at some point when people look back upon this historical period, they'll really see it being bookended at two ends by, you know, on 1840 and 2003, you know, wars, basically sort of expansionist wars, if you like, which are fueled by commerce and trade considerations and presented within this a certain kind of language.
Well, there's Amitabh Ghosh not stepping away one inch from his parallel drawing. Rajesh, thanks for your call. Kenny in Hampton, Virginia, you're on the air with Mr. Ghosh.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to comment on the book. I love the parallels that he makes from then to now. And it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, when people look at those books, you know, it's almost like a one view is kind of romanticized, you know, oh, this is the opium trade. But yet, more horrible things took place from the indigenous population than it took place for ones who benefited from it, you know. And, we have to draw the parallels today, you know, and how our people over in other countries are benefiting from a war, you know. And I think people really have to wake up and realize that, you know, yeah, it's entertainment, yes, but it's a real strong reality there, you know, that we really have to wake up to.
Kenny, you are tuned in very adroitly to what I found a really interesting balance in this book. And let me ask you, because on the one hand, you're unstinting in showing exactly not just the brutality, but the scale of it. You give us examples and make it easy for us to understand them across millions of people. On the other hand, you're in the book business, and you know how saleable the romance of this era and the accoutrements of this era are, as the artist, the writer, when you're sitting sort of juggling all these in your hand, you must have all this somehow in mind at once.
It was really, in a sense, my characters themselves who made this for me, a book which is also in many ways deeply pleasurable, you know? I mean, the writing of it even.
I was laughing out loud at many points, but yet that brutality is like a river under the whole thing.
You know, it's like life. I mean, terrible brutality exists and yet we laugh. You know, and one of the things that I was really struck by when I was reading about the lives of these transportees and these and the indentured coolies and so on, many, many observers comment on how much they laughed and how they sang and, you know, how they managed to find, some sort of pleasure even in their suffering. And I was very impressed by that because I do think that, you know, one of the things that's very striking to me about this past is that it also shows us the resilience of people, you know.
Mm.
And, you know, remember also that a lot of the white people who came to the Americas came as indentured workers.
My own first people here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Irish people, mm-hmm. Many, many Irish people came as indentured workers. And, you know, the 19th century was a very hard and difficult time. I mean, to be on a ship in the 19th century was very, very difficult. But yet, it was a kind of heightened experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this repeatedly from people's memoirs and so on. And I think, you know, it offered many different kinds of tastes of life.
One of the pleasures that you are clearly personally writing through this entire book, and it may be a bit of a hurdle for some, though I enjoyed it enormously, but it's what one of your characters calls the flash lingo of the East. You are clearly in love with the kind of language that grew up in between cultures in the cracks, and it's wild and wonderful. I mean, I'm just looking at one paragraph here with Tamashers and Notch Girls and Burakana and Shishmul and Shammers and Paltons and Kidmutgars and Demijohns and French Lalshrov and Carboys of Ice Simkin. I mean, wow, you the Fogfor of Mahachin you've got here. You're exercising your affection for this great wild language vigorously.
Well, Tom, you just you said a short while ago that in many ways cultures were more interpenetrated by each other in that time. And in fact, you know, it's actually the case that the English language of the 19th century was much, much more open to Asian influence than it is today, I think. Those words that you mentioned, almost all of them are actually in the Oxford English Dictionary. So
not exactly rolling off my tongue every day, but then there are many that now do. And was it the power of the wealth that was also flowing out of the East that made the English language open to these words? Just the presence of these cultures being woven in through the imperial and trade relations? Or?
I think, in a sense, language itself was much more fluid at that time because there wasn't such a prescriptive notion of grammar, such a prescriptive notion of standardized notion of spelling. Mm-hmm. In 19th century manuscripts, you always see words spelt in many different ways. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and I'm glad it's coming back today with texting, you know.
Well, and you've got these onboard conversations between Lascar and American and Brit and Chinese where as you convey these conversations, I imagine that even they only understood directly maybe half or two-thirds of what each other was saying, and yet they just plunge in and roll with it and pretty well understand each other quite completely.
Absolutely. I think people weren't so worried in that time about always speaking correctly. What was more important was just to be understood. But apart from that, there were these wonderful pidgin languages, you know, which allowed people to communicate on equal terms, you know. So, say, for example, the South China pidgin, which actually has profoundly influenced the English language.
Gung ho.
That's one, but much more common is this very common American phrase, can do.
It's almost the same thing.
No can do, can do. Mm-hmm. These are just direct translations of Cantonese phrases.
I want to get one more passage from you as the Ibis, the ship heads downriver from Calcutta, about to go out onto what they call the black water, the open sea. The women are on board thinking, the Indian women, who have essentially, they're going into this coolie servitude or are thinking of all they're about to leave behind.
Among the women, the talk was of the past and the little things that they would never see, nor hear, nor smell again. The color of poppies spilling across the fields like abir on a rain-drenched Holi. The haunting smell of cooking fires drifting across the river, bearing news of a wedding in a distant village. The sunset sounds of temple bells and the evening azan. Late nights in the courtyard listening to the tales of the elderly. No matter how hard the times at home may have been, in the ashes of every past there were a few cinders of memory that glowed with warmth, and now those embers of recollection took on a new life, in the light of which their presence here, in the belly of a ship that was about to be cast into an abyss, seemed incomprehensible, a thing that could not be explained except as a lapse from sanity. Diti fell silent as the other women spoke, for the recollections of the others served only to remind her of her daughter and the memories from which she would be forever excluded. The years of growing she would not see, the secrets she would never share, the bridegroom she would not receive. How was it possible that she would not be present at her child's wedding, to sing the laments that mothers sang when the palanquins came to carry their daughters away? In the escalating din, Diti's song was almost inaudible at first, but when the other women grew aware of it, they joined their voices to hers, one by one, all except Paulette. Slowly, as the women's voices grew in strength and confidence, the men forgot their quarrels. At home, too, during village weddings, it was always the women who sang when the bride was torn from her parents' embrace. It was as if they were acknowledging through their silence that they, as men, had no words to describe the pain of the child who was exiled from home.
Amitav Ghosh, reading from Sea of Poppies. Let me get one more call. Daniel in East Boston is calling. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hello, hi. This is a really fascinating program for me. I spent
a little Bengali greeting here. Very good.
Yes.
I spent 4 years in Bengal doing historical research, and it's just an absolutely fascinating program because I have relatives that one was Frederick Tudor, who was called the Ice King, who took ice from the ponds around Boston and took them to Calcutta to addict people to ice, to cold drinks.
Wow.
Which is, you know, not opium, but another, at that time they were totally unfamiliar with cold drinks.
Mm.
And
what a thought.
I haven't been able to find out, but it says that on his return journey, he was bringing back fruits. I wonder if he was also bringing back opium and if it was illegal at that time or...
Maybe really the fruit of the poppy. Daniel, our time is so short, but thank you so much for calling. Was there opium trade all the way back to the States? You've got your slave ship going out from Baltimore from India. Did the trade return all the way to the United States at that time?
Yes, I'm sure. Look, in those days, any ship would carry small consignments of everything. Incidentally, that ice house was a very, very famous location in Calcutta, and it was much celebrated.
Talk about exotic. Ice must have been about the most exotic thing you could have in Calcutta in 18.
It certainly changed the lives of Europeans in India very, very much because, they would take this ice from the lakes and just take it straight over there.
You know, there's one Abhik Bhattacharya in the Wall Street Journal takes issue, and he says, the book, Sea of Poppies, suggests that without Britain's interference, Indians of every stripe would have had a better chance at prosperity and happiness. Now, we know good and bad comes out of all kind of sweet and sour circumstances. Are you making that case that India, the world, would have been better off, period, without it, or is the intermingling somehow its own reward?
Look, I think, trade is a wonderful thing. As I said, the connections between people are always wonderful. But when this trade becomes something very, very destructive, like the slave trade or like the opium trade, it's a different issue altogether. Would Indians have been better and happier? Look, we do know that until the 18th century, India and China were contributing 50% of global GDP, and that's where we seem to be heading again.
Yes.
So, it was certainly not the case that Indians and Chinese couldn't get by without, without opium trade or without British interference.
Amitav Ghosh, I was absolutely beguiled by this book, and I thank you for the journey that I shared. Looking forward to the rest of the trilogy. The new novel is Sea of poppies. Amitav Ghosh, thanks so much for being with us today. It's just wonderful having you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a great, great pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Adore